Good afternoon, everybody. It's so nice to see all of you here. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. And you all know you can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver. I'm Vice Chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, former President and CEO of Charles Schwab Investment Management, and your moderator for the program. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, T.R. Reid, correspondent for the Washington Post, commentator for National Public Radio, and author of the new book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. T.R. has become one of the nation's best-known reporters through his books and articles, his documentary films, and his reporting for the Washington Post, and his lighthearted commentaries on NPR's Morning Edition. He majored in classics at Princeton University, and then subsequently worked as a naval officer, kind of different than being in classics, right?
Yep.
During the Vietnam War, a lawyer, a teacher, and assorted other roles. At the Washington Post, he has covered Congress and four presidential campaigns. He served as the paper's bureau chief in Tokyo and London, and reported from four dozen countries on five continents. Mr. Reid has written 10 books in English and three in Japanese, and translated one book from the Japanese. So his newest book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Fair, Simpler, and More Efficient Tax Code, suggests what we should do and should not do as Congress embarks on a major effort at reforming the federal tax system. So please welcome T.R. Reid.
Hi, everybody. It is just great to be here. I love coming to the Commonwealth Club. I love the fact that there is a Commonwealth Club, yeah. You know, because if there's one thing our country needs right now, it's a place for thoughtful, serious, civic, respected discussion on big issues facing our country. That's the Commonwealth Club. That's what you guys do. And so I'm grateful to the club. I'm grateful to all of you for supporting the club. And it was mentioned to me when I arrived here that they're raising millions of dollars for this beautiful new building. So don't forget that. It's tax time, isn't it? Yeah, this would be a good time. So very pleasant for me to be here. I love coming to San Francisco, but I have to say it fills me with envy. I live in Colorado. It's a pretty beautiful state. And better skiing than California, I think we're obliged to say that. And I kind of hate to admit it, but yesterday my daughter Penelope and I went up over the Golden Gate into the Marin Headlands and then came back down, and we saw the Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Bridge and the bay and the blinking lights of the city. What a place to live. I think you have it made. It makes me envious, even as a Coloradan. So really good to be here, and I love the San Francisco Public Library. This is a city that has really made a commitment to the public libraries. I usually go over to the main library when I'm here, and when I went over there yesterday, they have my new book. They have my new book. Well, you know, for an author, it's kind of a mixed feeling about that. Yeah, you want people to read the book, but my last book, which I also spoke about here, The Healing of America, was about how we could fix our rotten healthcare system. And I gave a speech on that book at the Aspen Institute in Colorado. And they have this nice tradition in Aspen. If you talk to the Aspen Institute, then that evening, a member of their board is assigned to be your host or hostess for dinner. It's kind of nice. And, you know, the kind of people who live in Aspen are on the board of the Aspen Institute. They're pretty well off. You know, they're doing pretty well. So sure enough, I gave my speech, and this nice woman came up to me afterwards and said, "Mr. Reid, thanks for coming. I'm going to be your hostess for dinner tonight at my house over at the base of Ajax, the ski mountain." And I said, "Yeah, that's really nice of you. How many people are coming to dinner?" And she said, "Well, only 42. That's all I can fit in the dining room." And so we got in her Lexus and drove over to this beautiful house with beam ceilings right at the base of Ajax, and had dinner. And at the end of dinner, she took a fork and clinked her glass, you know, and said, "Welcome, everybody. Nice to have you here. And I'm pleased to host Mr. T.R. something, whoever this guy is. She says, you know, I had never heard of this dude, T.R. Reid, before they assigned me to this dinner, but I can vouch for him. I think he's okay, because I went down to the Aspen Library and checked out three of his books, and I think he's a pretty serious guy. And I'm thinking, lady, you get in that Lexus and buy my books, you know? So there's always a little bit of schizophrenia when an author sees his book in the library. This new book I'm talking about, A Fine Mess, my editor came up with that title. The other day I did a radio interview, and the guy played a clip of Laurel saying to Hardy, here's another fine mess you've gotten me into. It was good. Anyway, it's kind of in the same genre as some of my other books, which I think you could call, I think the economists would call it comparative policy analysis, or maybe best practices or something like that. And here's the idea, it's pretty simple idea. The idea is if your club or your college or your company or your country has a serious problem, well, a good way to fix it is to look at what other clubs or companies or countries have done and see if they had a good idea. And that's what I've been doing in several of my books. I did a book on crime problems. As you know, the United States, it's a terrific country, but we have the biggest prison population in the world, and many other advanced democracies have less of a crime problem than we do. My last book, which I talked about here, was about why it is that all the other rich democracies manage to provide health care for everybody and still spend half as much as we do. And my argument is we could do it too. I think the United States should provide health care for everybody, and I know we could. I know we could, because all the other countries do it. In fact, I would like you to, you could still go out and buy my health care book, but if you don't want to, I can reduce that whole book to a bumper sticker. Are you ready? If France can do it, the United States can do it. That's my whole argument right there. And so now I'm doing the same thing for taxes. I'll tell you how all this came about. I was a foreign correspondent for the Washington Post. I was working in the Washington Post newsroom. You've seen the movie All the President's Men, which is a total perfect replica of our newsroom. And if I don't know if you remember this, quite small D Democratic. Nobody gets an office. Everybody, all the reporters sit at a desk, and right next to you is the next desk, and right next to you is the next desk. And they align them up in rows. So the six or seven people who cover politics, they're all seated together. The economics reporters are together. The people who do the State Department and foreign policy, they're kind of the intellectual snobs of the newsroom. They're all in a row. And then at the end of the row is your editor, is the editor for those reporters. And I think this is a really good architecture for putting out a daily newspaper. But I never liked it. I never liked it. I liked the paper. I liked the job. I didn't like the editor down there. You know, your boss is only 10 feet away at all times. She can come down and read over your shoulder. I never liked that. I don't get along with authority. So I spent a lot of time actually thinking, I like the job. I like the paper. But I wonder if I could get more than 10 feet from the boss. And I finally came up with a pretty drastic solution. I moved 10,000 miles from the boss. I became a foreign correspondent, and that really worked. That really worked. In East Asia, I never talked to them. I would file my story about 11 p.m. Tokyo time. That was an hour before they went to work. And then if they ever called me to ask a question, I'd say, God, do you know what time it is here? You know, after a couple of weeks, they stopped calling. So it worked fine. And I developed a career plan, which I recommend to all young people, and that is, never work within 10 time zones of the boss. This one really works fine for me. And things were going well. Our family was having a good time there. And here's what happened. I have a daughter who constantly gets otitis media earaches. My son fell off his skateboard and cracked his collarbone. In other words, we had to go to the doctor. And at first, we were kind of leery about this because we're Americans. We know Americans do everything well, best. But we went to the doctor, and in all the rich countries where we lived, here's what we found. The care was great, facilities were fine, we didn't have to wait that long, and the bills were tiny, one-tenth, one-twentieth what you would pay for the same treatment in America. In fact, when we lived in Japan, quite often I didn't bother to send the doctor bill home to the insurance company because the postage was more than the doctor bill. This is really true. So anyway, I just got interested in this as a reporter. This is what reporters do. How do they do that? How do they cover everybody with good results at half our cost? And I went to my editor, the great Ann Godoff, who's the president now of Penguin Press. She was at Random House then. I said, Ann, I got a great idea, I'm going to go to the doctor around the world and see how healthcare systems work. And I could just see her face. Oh, God, you know. Health policy. No, she says, I've done health policy. Those books never sell. And anyway, I wrote it. She paid for the book. I wrote it anyway. And we happened to bring it out during the debate on Obamacare. People who buy books were interested in health policy. It just sold like crazy. It hit the New York Times list the first week. It sold better than any. Most of my books have flopped. That one really did beautifully. And about a year later, Ann Godoff called me to say, boy, that book of yours, it's still selling. We've really done great on that book. I'm so glad I thought of it, she said. Well, it was my idea. But, you know, she's the boss. So what are you going to say? I said, Ann, great idea you had. Yeah, it really were. Anyway, so 3 years ago, Ann called me up and said, here's my new idea. This is going to be great. We're going to catch another wave. We're going to have a big national debate on tax reform. So go around the world and look at other tax systems and figure out what we ought to do and what we shouldn't do to fix our rotten, unfair, inefficient tax code. And that's what I did. And guess what? The idea actually, it was her idea, but it works pretty well for a couple of reasons. For one thing, it turns out any idea that anybody has had in America, left, right, far right, to fix our tax code, some country has tried it. There's good laboratory experimentation on every idea. I mean, for example, many conservatives or Republicans like the idea of a flat rate tax where everybody pays 18%. You remember Herman Cain had the 999 plan? In 2016, six of the Republican candidates proposed flat rate tax codes. Well, turns out 12 countries tried it. And if you buy my book, you can find out how it worked. It didn't. It turns out, if you're a former Soviet republic with no investment capital and a place where everybody's poor and there's no disparity of income, well, then a flat rate tax will work for a few years. It worked for a few years in those countries and then didn't. But it wouldn't work here. That's the basic thing. Democrats like the idea of a carbon tax. It brings in revenue and it fights global warming. Australia put in the world's best, most respected carbon tax that all the environmental groups liked. It lasted 2 years. At the next election, the opposition party ran on a campaign of axe the tax. They won and they killed that tax. Nobody liked it because it made everybody's electric bill go up. And the power companies very thoughtfully put on every bill, the reason your bill went up is that dumb tax. And so they axed it. So that one turns out to be hard. You remember Bernie Sanders was going to give everybody free tuition at public universities and pay for it with what he called a Wall Street speculators tax, financial activities tax. I think this one works. Several countries have done this. The EU is going to put it in place this year. This tax is interesting. It's a tax on stock trading or on big commodity purchases or derivative trading. And it's a tiny tax. What's the sales tax in California? Is it 8% or something? The financial activities tax in Europe is 0.0001% of the transaction. It's not 1% tax. It's 0.001. That's $1 on $1 million transaction is the tax. So when you and I trade stocks, what's it going to cost us? 20 cents or something, 10 cents. But it actually brings in tons of money because these traders, you know, they do 100 trades a second at $1 billion each. So I think that tax is a good idea. Guess what? When this is proposed in the United States, for some reason Wall Street opposes it, and they have clout in Congress. But the point is, all these ideas have been tried. So there's good. That's what my book is about. Which one should we do? Which one shouldn't we do? But here's the other thing you get out of looking at other countries' tax codes. You can get an answer to this question, are we overtaxed? Do Americans pay more tax than other countries? You know, right this week, nobody's happy about writing the check to the IRS. Do we pay more? Well, here's one expert. I'll quote one expert, Donald Trump, the President of the United States. America is the highest tax country in the world. He said it 200 times or more during the 2016 campaign. Is he right? It's an alternative fact. No, he's wrong. So the standard measure of how much people have to pay in tax is a statistic called overall tax burden. And this is computed by the International Monetary Fund and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. That's kind of a United Nations just for rich countries. And here's what they do. They total up all the federal, local, and state taxes in the whole country and take the total of that as a percentage of GDP, of total wealth. And on that standard measure of tax burden of the 35 richest countries, the United States ranks 32nd, near the bottom. Chile, Mexico, and South Korea tax less than we do, and everybody else taxes much more. We collect about 25% of GDP in total taxes at all levels. Now, what country do you suppose is the world champion at heavy taxing? France is very high, yeah. Sweden, somebody said. Scandinavia, yes, Denmark, yeah. Denmark, Sweden, Belgium, and France tax at about 47 or 48% of all wealth is taxed in a year. And people put up with that because people in those countries, nobody likes paying tax, but they like government more than Americans do, and so they're willing to put up with it. And the U.S., as I say, is about 25%, way down the list of rich countries in terms of total burden. We pay less in income tax, pay less in Social Security tax, less in capital gains tax, less gas tax, less tobacco tax, lower sales taxes. Trump was right about the U.S. being a high-tax country in terms of the corporate income tax. And I bet you've heard this. Our corporate income tax, it's a graduated tax, but the top rate is 35%, and most companies pay the 30, or are supposed to pay the 35%. Actually, any company that actually paid 35% in income tax would fire the CFO the next morning because nobody does. But even the effective rate, the amount they actually pay, is about 25, 26%. That's more than their competitors in other countries. And this doesn't make sense. It's not a sensible thing to do. For one thing, it does put American corporations at a disadvantage vis-a-vis their competitors in Japan or Germany or Britain or wherever. And second, when you set a tax rate too high, guess what happens? People find ways not to pay. When you set a tax rate high, then it's in your interest to pay an accountant or a lawyer or a consultant to duck tax. In my book, I tell the story about Caterpillar, this iconic American company makes big yellow earth movers and tractors. They're headquartered in Peoria, Illinois. You know, how American can you get? And they paid Price Waterhouse $55 million to come up with the tax cutting scheme. It saved them $8 billion. They moved their whole spare parts business to Switzerland on paper. All the warehouses are in America, all the sales offices are in America, but on paper, the headquarters is in Switzerland. It saved them tons of money. If the rate were lower, it would not probably have been in their interest to go to all the trouble to duck the tax. So this is an important lesson I found throughout my book. As you raise the rate of tax, you get diminishing returns because rich people won't pay. France is the world champion at gouging the rich. And for a while, they had what they called a hypertax, 75% top rate. And guess what? Rich people moved to Belgium. You know, rich people moved to Britain to avoid it, and they had to cut that tax. It didn't work. I agree that we ought to cut our corporate tax rate. The question is how you pay for the lost revenue. And I think the way to do it is to get rid of some of these hundreds and hundreds of loopholes and giveaways and credits and deductions in the code. And then you could tax them at a lower rate. We'll see. I think that change, some change along those lines is going to come. And then the other area where we do pay more than most, not all, but most other rich countries is the estate tax, the inheritance tax. When a rich guy dies and leaves $50 million to the kids, the kids are taxed. And if you may remember that the Republicans hired a very smart PR guy to fight this tax, and he labeled it the death tax. Do you remember that? I argue in my book that that's wrong. The dead guy doesn't pay the tax. I mean, what if he avoided the tax? We're going to, you know, put his corpse in jail? He doesn't pay the tax. It's the rich heir, the lucky rich kid who got the money, who pays the tax. And I don't have any objection to that, because it doesn't tax investment, it doesn't tax savings, it doesn't tax labor. If you work for the money, by definition, you don't pay the estate tax. So I think it's a good tax. Ours, you got to be really rich to pay it. One in 70,000 Americans pays the estate tax because you have to inherit at least $11 million before you pay the first penny of tax. So for all these reasons, I like that tax. But a lot of countries that we think of as kind of lefty, big government, high tax countries have gotten rid of the estate tax. Sweden dumped the estate tax. Belgium dumped the estate tax, and Canada dump the estate tax. And the argument for it, for getting rid of it, is kind of the death tax argument. You know, enough is enough. God, I paid taxes for 65 years. Now you're going to tax me when I'm dead? You know, leave me alone. And the argument for the slogan when they proposed this in Canada, the slogan for getting rid of the estate tax, I loved it. It was great. No taxation without respiration. And in Sweden, I asked the leading tax economist, Olofsson, gee, I said, Sweden, you guys like taxes. You know, you're a big taxer. Why'd you get rid of the estate tax? And I don't know, was he joking? He said to me, well, we tax them so much when they're alive, there's not much to get after they die. So maybe that's why they did it. So Americans overall, not counting our corporation, but Americans pay less in tax than our counterparts in other countries like us, advanced democracies. We pay less, but we complain more. Nobody bitches about taxes more than the United States. Now, nobody in the world likes paying taxes. Nobody's happy about it. They see it's necessary. But, you know, in most countries, the revenue agency, the Federal Revenue Collection Agency, the IRS, whatever you want to call it, is a respected arm of government. Now, in America, the Internal Revenue Service advises its employees not to tell people where they work. You know, at a cocktail party, just say, I'm in the federal government, you know, kind of thing. And there's some sense to that. A few years ago, some tax protester flew his plane into the IRS building in Austin, Texas, and killed four employees. And he left a note saying, take that, tax man. So, in other countries, the revenue agency, the Inland Revenue in Britain, the Servicio de Impuestos, like that, they're very proud. They're proud government agencies. They're respected. And IRS agents in other countries, they have blazers with a badge on it. They have baseball caps. They have songs. They have marching bands. They have slogans. They're proud. In Sweden, the Swedish government polls the citizenry every year about government, and most years the revenue agency is the most respected agency. People like dealing with them. Many of these IRSs have slogans. In the Netherlands, the slogan is, we can't make paying taxes pleasant, but at least we can make it easy. I really like that. Don't you like that? And they do, as I'll explain in a minute. In Chile's IRS, the Servicio de Impuestos, they have a mascot. You know, like the mascots that run around the baseball field or the football field. It's a furry chinchilla. It's a little chinchilla. It's a guy in a furry chinchilla suit. His name is Ivo, I-V-O, because I-V-A means a sales tax in Spanish. He's Ivo, and Ivo goes around to schools and parks and shopping malls and sings the praises of tax. He has a band, and he sings... And he says, son bacanes los impuestos. Those taxes, they're awesome. schools, parks, bridges, hospitals. We wouldn't have them if you didn't pay your tax, he says. You can do that in those countries. The one I really like is in Japan. In Japan, the movie that won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, and Best Actress was a movie called Marusa no Ona, which means Audit Bureau Woman. Audit Bureau Woman. And this movie stars this peppy, pretty, lovable movie star, Miyamoto Nobuko, who's kind of the Meg Ryan of Japan, or the Tina Fey, or the Amy Schumer of Japan. She stars in this film as a peppy, pretty, dedicated young tax auditor. And she's a beginner at first. So at the beginning, she works in the Tokyo Audit Bureau. And at first, they assign her. She's new, you know. So they assign her to small accounts, to little guys. They give her this tiny, tiny little mom-and-pop grocery store on a corner. And so Nobuko, she's quite diligent. So she stands outside with her calculator and adds up every purchase that she can see in that store for a week. And then on Friday, she goes in and says to mom and pop, well, I see you had total sales of 24,618,411 yen this week, but you only paid 1,213,000 yen in tax. You're way under. And then she says, and very politely, she says, it is my honor to respectfully inform you that you owe 4,450,318 yen in back tax. Pay up. And the mom in this mom and pop store gets furious. 4 million yen. Where the hell am I going to get 4 million yen? She says. Why are you going after me anyway? Why don't you go after those big guys who cheat all the time? And Nobuko kind of looks at the camera and says, yeah, that makes sense. So she goes back to the boss and says, give me a big account. Don't put me on mom and pop. And he says, okay, right, that's what you want. I'm going to put you on the worst tax evader in Japan. And this is a yakuza, a kind of a gangland kingpin. And he owns a bunch of these two-hour love hotels. You know, they have shack-up hotels all over Tokyo. It's a big business. And it's a pretty good business for a tax evader because, you know, if you take your mistress to a love hotel, you tend not to pay with a credit card. You know, you don't want any record. So everybody pays in cash. And this guy rides around Tokyo in a chauffeur-driven white Bentley from hotel to hotel and collects the cash. And meanwhile, Nobuko is following him on a little red scooter, you know, everywhere he goes, you know, really determined. And finally, in the climactic scene, she finds the spot where he keeps whatever records he has, and she's digging through all the papers and all this stuff. She finds the document that will send him to jail, and the whole audience cheers. They go crazy. And I say in my book, can you imagine casting Tina Fey as a peppy, pretty tax auditor who nails some guy and everybody cheers for it? I mean, we wouldn't do that. So we pay less but complain more. And one of the big complainers is a guy who I think really has made out great under our tax code, and that was Mitt Romney. If you remember, in 2012, Mitt Romney ran for president, and he complained only 47% of Americans pay the income tax, which is factually true. It's a misleading argument because all those people, they pay Social Security tax, they pay property tax, they pay sales tax, they pay gas tax, they pay a lot of taxes for government services. They don't happen to pay it through the income tax. But I thought, and I wrote in my book, Mitt Romney, what's he complaining about? He's a big winner in our tax code because he takes this fabulous write-off called the carried interest rule that says people in investment banking and hedge funding, that was his line of work, pay tax at a lower rate than people who, you know, work for their living and make a wage. It just doesn't seem right. No other country has this loophole. And if you remember, Romney was required to release one of his tax returns. He felt the pressure. And in that, it was his 2010 return. Mitt and Ann Romney made $22 million that year. Most of it was deferred compensation from his hedge fund from years earlier. And they're very generous people. They gave a lot to charity and everything. But when they ended up paying their tax, they paid tax on $20 million at 13%. That's less than a family of four making $100,000, 1/100th of what they made. Is that a fair code? I mean, he's a big winner. What's he complaining about, I say? And the other trouble for Romney is kind of interesting. When his tax return came out, you could see on it that he had a bunch of money deposited in the Cayman Islands. And the Cayman Islands is a notorious tax haven. You put your money in the Cayman Islands so that the IRS won't know about it. That's why people do that. But Romney, he was kind of embarrassed by this, so he said, well, we have some funds in the Caymans, but not for tax purposes. And the tax lawyer, Frank Schuchat, said, well, to say I have money in the Caymans, but not for tax purposes, is like saying, yeah, I bought those condoms, but not for sex.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Now, so we pay less than most other countries. We complain more. And I argue, I think that's not too surprising if you think about it. If you think about our attitude, Americans' attitude towards government and towards taxation, we don't like government as much as people in Western Europe do. We don't like government as much as people in the other advanced democracies. We'd rather, you know, we say we'd rather be left alone and do stuff on our own. I debated Grover Norquist, you know, this famous tax protester. And he said, we don't need all this taxation. Let's get rid of the taxation. Well, you know, Grover, did you build a street from your house to this TV studio? No, he rode on the government street. He uses government services. And if you use them, seems fair to me that you ought to pay for them. But we don't particularly like government, and therefore we don't like paying tax for government. And as a matter of fact, Americans do much more through private charity than the other rich democracies. We give far more than people in other democracies to private charity, 2% of our GDP. That's 100 times what the French give to charity. It's 50 times what the Brits give to charity, because they pay their taxes and then expect government to do this stuff, hospitals, Commonwealth Club, the kind of things that we fund through schools, that we fund through taxation, that we fund through charity, they fund through taxation. Well, all right, I can understand that. Another reason we don't like taxes is because we've made it so hard to pay. We've made it so hard to pay. There's no question, I can tell you, having gone around the world and looked, that the Internal Revenue Code of the United States of America is by far the most complicated and most difficult tax code on the planet. Nobody comes anywhere close. According to the IRS, American families and firms together spend 6 billion hours a year gathering the data and filling out the forms. A family at the median income, about $56,000, spends 12 to 13 hours keeping records and gathering the records and giving them to the tax preparer, and on average, $260 just to get your tax returns filed. In other words, you have to spend money to send money to the government. Nobody in the country would stand for this. In other rich countries, it takes 15 minutes and $0 to pay your tax. It just doesn't take any time. I was in, no wonder we complain. Why have we made it so hard? And anyway, what are you doing at a speech? It's due next week, you know. Beautiful April days when we ought to be out on the golf course or at the kids' soccer game. We're fighting over IRS instructions. I mentioned this in my book. I said fighting over IRS instructions like this one, and what I needed was an IRS instruction that was so complicated it was funny. And I went to the IRS, and there's a woman there, Nina Olson, fabulous woman. She's the hero of my book. She is the official U.S. government taxpayer advocate. Her job is to work in the IRS and represent you and me. And her major complaint, she's required to report to Congress every year on the biggest problems facing American taxpayers. She's the only taxpayer advocate we've ever had. She's had the job 13 years, and she says to me, 13 years in a row, I've told Congress the major problem is that our system is too complicated. And then she says, and every year they make it worse. On average, they add 400 new exemptions or credits or deductions to the tax code every year. Some lobbyist goes in and says, my client wants this. You make a little contribution, and the thing gets done. Anyway, so I went to Nita Olson and said, hey, I'm at a point in my book. I need a typical IRS instruction that's so complicated it's funny. And she said, but there's so many of those. I put 5 of them in my book in the end, and they're in there. Here's the thing. It doesn't have to be that way. Paying taxes doesn't have to be hard. It doesn't have to cost any money. Other countries have done what our Congress seems incapable of doing. They've made paying your taxes simple. For example, a year ago on March 31st, I was in Amsterdam. In the Netherlands, tax day is April 1st. I was with a mid-level executive. He makes about $200,000 a year. Big range of investments. He gives to charity. He has 2 kids in private schools, 2 houses with mortgages. In America, he'd have to fill out 12 forms. And I said to him, it's March 31st, it's due tomorrow. I said, Michael, how do you do your taxes? He said, well, I pop a beer and I go online, and the IRS in the Netherlands has filled in every line of the form for him. They know the numbers. And he says, I take a look and have a drink, and if the numbers look okay, I hit okay. It takes about 5 minutes. He says, that's what it should be, he says. He says, but, Michael says to me, I'm what I think you Yanks would call a Republican. He says, I don't really trust government that much. So, some years I try to check some of the numbers. Now he's getting mad, He says, you start checking the numbers on that return. I mean, it can take almost half an hour just to pay your taxes. And that's standard. And the reason is the government fills in the form for you. In Japan, here's how it works. In Japan, in early March, you get a postcard from Kokuzeicho, that's their IRS, and it says, we think you earned this much last year. We withheld this much. We owe you a refund of this much, and we'll put it in your bank account on April 1st. Or, we think you owe us this much, and we're going to take it out of your bank account. If the postcard looks right, you file it away and you're done. 85% of the people in Japan never file a tax return. Guess what? No H&R Block anywhere in Japan. They don't need it. Now, here's what really bugs me. We could do this too. The IRS knows almost all the numbers for most American families. If you take the itemized deduction particularly, or if your big deduction is your mortgage interest, they know that. They have all those records. I don't know. You may not know this, but many people every year, millions of people every year, get a notice from the IRS called a CP2000 notice. I get this most years. And it's not an audit. This is a correction. This is a notice that says, we see that on line 149Z, you entered $4,711. The number should have been $4,841. And I'm thinking, if they knew that already, why did I spend hours trying to figure out this number, and why did I put it on the wrong line? Why? The IRS could do this for most American families. The economists call this system pre-filled forms or pre-populated returns. And California has this. Do you know this? The ready return system for your California state taxes. They don't advertise it, but it's very popular among the very small number of Californians who use it. This idea of pre-filled forms is introduced in Congress every year. Let's have the IRS, they know all the numbers anyway, let's have them fill out the form for Americans. And when that's introduced, can you guess what happens? H&R Block lobbies against it. That's exactly right. And Intuit, the maker of TurboTax, they spend millions fighting this idea. So have a nice time this weekend working on your taxes. It doesn't have to be that way. My argument is, if we did this, if we moved to pre-filled forms and let the government do the work for us, as it does in almost all other democracies, then April 15th would just be another sunny spring day. and we'd be fine. That's what we ought to do. One other point I'd like to make about taxation is we do have a major problem in America that Americans have figured out, and that is inequality of wealth and income. The gap between the very rich and the rest of us is growing dramatically, which, you know, it leads to people living in spectacular penthouses or in private communities with private libraries and private fire departments and separate from the rest of us. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the numbers since 2009, since the end of the Great Recession, most American families have seen about 1 or 2% growth in real income. The top 1% has seen a 30% growth. That is, all the growth, almost all the growth, has gone to the top. This is the argument of the 99% and the 1%. All the rich countries have this to a degree. The U.S. has it worse, has a worse problem with inequality than other countries. And taxation is a very good way to deal with this. If you have a graduated tax rate, if you tax the stuff like Bentleys that rich people buy, then you can offset this inequality and you use the revenue to do job training or to build infrastructure and create jobs for other people. So in many countries, they've decided that taxation is a good answer to this issue. Whether America would do it or not, I don't know. Anyway, so this is the point of my book, that if we look at what other countries have done, we can see what we ought to do to fix the world's most complicated and inefficient tax code, and what we should never do. And you know, I know you some of you are busy, and you may not have time to read my book. I'll grant you that. I mean, you know, you could still buy it. That doesn't take any time. If you do, I think you'll see the lesson. I'll tell you the lesson of my book right now. My argument is, if Americans could find the political will to fix our rotten tax code, if we had the will, the other rich countries can show us the way. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to T.R. Reid, correspondent for the Washington Post and commentator for National Public Radio and author of the new book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. It's now time for our question period, and I have a number of questions from many of you and some that I came up with as I read your book.
Fine.
One of the big tenets in your book is the BBLT, the broad-based lower tax
lower
concept.
Rates, yeah.
Lower rates concept.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. When I started this book, I went to the World Bank and the IMF and said, what makes a good tax code? They know. They advise tax companies, countries all over the world on taxes. And it's a pretty simple formula to explain. It's not that easy to put into practice. BBLR. BBLR, that's the secret code. It means broaden the base and you can lower the rates. Broaden the base and you can lower the rates. And here's what happens. To broaden the base, you say everything you earn is income. Your salary, that's income. If your employer pays your health insurance premium, well, otherwise you'd have to pay it, so that's income to you. In many countries, if your employer provides free parking, they say, well, that would have cost you $20 a month. That's income to you. Everything is income, and then you don't get all these deductions and exemptions that we have. You want to give money to charity? That's great. We're all for it, but we're not giving you a tax break. You want to take out a mortgage to buy a house? Fine. We encourage that, but we're not going to give you a tax break. If you do that, if you get the broad base, then you can raise the same amount of revenue with very low rates, much lower rates than the U.S. has. And when rates are lower, all the history shows that people are more likely to pay. Tax feels less like robbery if it's 12% than if it's 40%. And therefore, you get better rates of compliance. And of course, if you get rid of all the giveaways, then you have fewer forms and the whole system is easier. So BBLR is the magic formula. Many countries have done it. Could the United States do that, our polarized country? We did. We did. In 1986, Ronald Reagan, a conservative Republican, was president. Tip O'Neill, a liberal from Massachusetts, was Speaker of the House, and they agreed on the most far-reaching tax reform in American history, the Internal Revenue Code of 1986. They did BBLR. They broadened the base. They took away all sorts of credits and exemptions and giveaways and brought the top rate down from 70% to 28% in that change. And it worked. And then guess what happened? Then the lobbyists came back, and over the next 30-some years, all those giveaways got stuck back in the code. So now we've had to raise the top rate to 39.6%. We should do BBLR again. I argue in my book that we will, because everybody can see our code is a monster that has to be tamed.
Thank you. And so how would you implement it in such a way that it would be fair to people who might be severely impacted? And I know you had a great example with New Zealand in there where they took the Band-Aid off and just took away all the exemptions all at once, right?
Yeah, I think the way to do it for everybody is you got to do it big. Bill Bradley was a basketball player, became a U.S. senator. He was the intellectual genius behind this 1986 tax reform. He said, you got to change the whole damn thing at once. And that's what the other countries have said, too. And then, you know, people lose their cherished deduction, right? But you get a lower rate. You get a simpler return. In other words, for everything you don't like in the big package, there's stuff you do like, and that's the political trade-off that makes it pass.
And so for charitable deductions, to your earlier point, does that hurt the charities that rely on
No, I think there's no question that taking away the charitable deduction would not cut contribution to charity. For one thing, if you look at other countries, I list 15 of them in my book, took away, it used to be every country had a deduction for charitable contributions, and it became a big drag on their revenues. So most countries have taken it away, and there's a standard pattern. For 1 or 2 years, there's a dip in contributions, and after about the third year, they start going up again at the rate of income. The charitable deduction in America costs the Treasury $73 billion a year. We could use that money to treat veterans. We could build a border wall if you want to do that. We could cut the deficit. And instead, it goes as a subsidy mainly to the rich because most Americans, two-thirds of Americans, take the standard deduction. They don't even get it. You shouldn't say this, I guess, in a place like the Commonwealth Club, particularly when they're raising money for this beautiful new building they're going to build. But as a matter of fact, without that deduction, people's rates would go down. You'd have more take-home pay, and people would give just as much or more. That's my argument.
Right. Great. And so along those lines, you know, Washington is looking at do the repeal and replace bill first before they do a tax bill.
Well, they go back and forth on
they
that,
go back
yeah,
and
as
forth.
Of today, yes.
Right. And one of the reasons they've said that they want to do the health care bill first is because they'll have a lot of savings from that to help pay for the tax reform.
Yeah.
But if BBLR is almost, it can raise more money with a broader base,
yes.
Why do we need then a repeal and replace bill first?
No, right? That's exactly right. They want to repeal and replace because it lowers the overall amount of tax income, and that changes the estimates in the scorekeeping for the tax break. That's why they wanted to do it. It's kind of an obscure point, but I don't think they're going to get health care done. It doesn't look like they have a plan that can pass. So, but if they did the BBLR approach to tax reform, as we did in 86 and as many countries have done, then we could sharply lower the rates without losing revenue. And as I said, you just get better compliance at lower rates. We do better if we simplified the code and charge less.
Right. In your book, you also talk about VAT, the value-added tax.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that here? I know we've debated this a lot, and
one of
the few countries that doesn't have it.
Yeah, almost all countries have it. The VAT is it's kind of a super sales tax. In California, you pay a retail sales tax when you buy my book. When you buy my book, you're going to pay 8% tax above the price. In a VAT system, every level of transaction paid a tax. When the publisher bought the paper from the lumber mill, they paid tax. When they bought the ink, they paid tax. When they sent the book to the printer, They paid tax, and when the book was then sold to the wholesaler paid a tax, the distributor paid a tax, the retailer pays a tax to the distributor, and then you pay a tax to the retailer. It's a chain of taxation, and the beauty of that is every time that tax is paid, it's reported to the government. So governments love the VAT. It's a very easy tax to collect and a very hard tax to evade. Economists like it because it taxes consumption. It doesn't tax work or savings or investment. It taxes consumption. And people like it if you do it right. If you use the VAT to lower the tax on income and Social Security and stuff like that, then taxpayers like it too. So 176 countries have adopted this innovation. The only ones that haven't are a bunch of poor countries that can't afford to have any tax, and the United States of America, the world's richest country. We should do this. Eric Zoll is a professor at UCLA Law School. He's advised about 40 countries on how to build a tax code, and he said to me, you know, the VAT is such a good idea, even the U.S. Congress will eventually figure it out. He says, mark my words, within 5 years, the U.S. will have a VAT. And then he said, I've been saying that for 20 years.
So the argument then for many on the VAT is that the lower income folks would end up paying because they consume more at that level,
that's
right?
That's a totally fair argument. Yeah. Low income people use a higher percentage of their income just for basic purchases. There are two ways to deal with that. One is you exempt stuff that everybody has to buy. You exempt food, clothing, medical supplies, textbooks, and then that gets complicated. Mm-hmm. If you exempt groceries but not restaurants and somebody buys 3 ounces of ham, is that lunch or is that tomorrow's dinner? So the better way to do it, which many countries have done, is you tax everything with the VAT, and then you give low-income people a credit on their income tax, so they come out ahead. A couple of countries pay it in advance. They pay you all the sales tax they think you're going to pay on January 1st, so that low-income people don't get nailed by it. I think we should do this. It's a good idea, and it would let us lower the rates of all the other taxes.
I followed your argument really well in that book, and it was very clear.
You bought it?
I bought it, yeah. You said the carbon tax, we talked a little bit about the carbon tax, is not successful in Australia. But can you comment on the net neutral carbon tax in British Columbia, for example, or net neutral taxes in general?
Yeah, that's a good argument. Australia tried this on a national basis, and it was important in Australia. It's a very green, outdoorsy country. And they have tons of coal, so they got all their electricity from coal, and therefore it's dirty. And they tried to fix this up. So the reason I looked at Australia is, God, if anybody could do a carbon tax, it ought to be this very green country, and they couldn't make it work. British Columbia has made it work. There's a emissions trading scheme, which is a form of carbon tax in the EU that works quite well. They've made that work. Anybody who emits carbon, including railroads, airlines, and automakers, pays a tax for having done so. It brings in revenue. It encourages people to do greener stuff. It can work. It did not work in Australia and a couple other countries. I just list that as a warning. It's not automatic.
So then, along those lines, what do you think about using taxes to set social public policies?
Yeah, it's a very good question. What are taxes for? Well, taxes are what we pay for civilized society, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said. It pays for government. But there are a lot of other reasons for tax. Tax turns out to be a very good way to encourage people to do things we like give to charity maybe. And even better is it's a good way to stop people from doing stuff that causes a cost to society. This is called the sin tax. Mm-hmm. You tax sin. For example, in New York, Mayor Bloomberg banned big sugar soda pop. The courts threw it out. Everybody hated it. People rebelled. That was kind of big government nanny state. It was a good idea because it fought obesity, it fights tooth decay, but he did it wrong. He should have done it with a tax on sugared soda like Oakland, California did, mm-hmm. Like Denver has done, like Boulder has done. and Great Britain is putting in a sugar tax. That one works. The classic case of the sin tax that worked is the tax on tobacco. In the 1960s, the tax on a pack of tobacco was 30 cents. 42% of American adults smoked every day. Mm-hmm. Today, that tax, what is it, $6 in California?
Like
$5 where I live in Colorado, 16% of Americans smoke. Well, we had education programs. We put warnings on the pack. But that's a tax that works. So, yeah, taxes serve many purposes. As I said, taxes tend to offset inequality if they're done correctly. And although it's probably not a necessity in an established country like the United States, but in newly developed countries in Eastern Europe or Africa, a sound, honest tax system creates confidence in the government. It creates a sense of belonging. This is called the nationalization argument for tax, and political scientists are crazy about this idea. Have a good tax code. And you know the Greeks are notorious for skipping tax. They don't, nobody pays tax there. And this current government, the Silesia government, got into office running on tougher taxes. Can you imagine that? We're going to make everybody pay, and people like that idea. That seemed right, that everybody should pay.
That's great. I'm going to take a quick commercial break. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest is Washington Post correspondent and NPR commentator T.R. Reid, who's discussing how to best reform the U.S. tax system. And I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, and you can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on radio and catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube. So another question around, you talked about the movie with the Japanese tax enforcer.
Audit Bureau Woman.
Audit Bureau Woman. So how much should you spend, how much should we spend on enforcement in this country with tax code? Now, I understand if we go to the BBLR, it probably won't be quite so much, right?
Should be easier.
It should easier,
be easier both for taxpayers and tax collectors. The IRS brags, and accurately so, that it's a very efficient collector. Their records show that they spend 35 cents for every 100 bucks they collect. And that's quite low by standards of federal tax agencies around the world. It's a little less admirable because they do it by sticking all the work on us. You know, they make it so hard for us to pay that they can keep their costs down. But at that level of spending, they don't do enough auditing. They just can't bring in. There's something called a tax gap, and the tax gap is of all the money that you should bring in at the established tax rates in your country, how much of it do you really collect? And the tax gap is quite big in America compared to Britain or Germany or Japan or Spain because Congress, to punish the IRS, has cut its budget. And the IRS commissioner, John Koskinen, said, they asked us to do more with less, but let's be honest, we're going to do less with less. If we put more money into enforcement, it would bring in much more money than we'd spend on it and have, you know, it would offset the deficit. And I've said to the Republicans who do cut the IRS, you know, it's just bad business. I mean, if you were running a business, would you cut your biggest profit center? No, it brings in more money per capita than any other government agency. So, you know, in terms of budget terms, it's just dumb to cut it.
So you have great ideas. Who in Congress can you go to support these ideas? And who have you talked to? And how long do you think it might be before we can see some of these coming into play?
Yeah, I don't think my proposals in my book are pie in the sky for a couple of reasons. One, other countries like us have done most of them. And two, I think everybody now realizes that our tax code is a monster. It's terrible. It's incredibly complicated. It gives, you know, Warren Buffett pays a lower rate of tax than his secretary. He's confirmed that that's true. It's unfair. It's complicated. It's inefficient. We could do much better. And I think everybody sees that, Republican and Democratic. And our current president, I don't know, can you believe what he said? He said he is going to provide, here I'll quote him, major tax reform. It sounds like him, doesn't it?
It does. And you'll like it.
And you'll like, yes.
And it'll be beautiful.
It's going to be a beautiful thing to watch. He said, no, here's the Donald Trump tax plan. I have it written down here. Are you ready?
Yes.
My tax plan will be so great it'll make your head spin. There it is, right there. But if they mean it, they could do it. There are people in the Treasury Department who know how to design a good tax code. There are experts all over America who are hired to work for the Brits and the Spaniards and the Japanese and the South Koreans designing their tax code. We could do this, as I said, if we could find the political will. And it means standing up to moneyed interests who each want their own deduction. I'm pretty confident. Here's why. I think history repeats itself. So we started the federal income tax in 1913. It was a very popular tax then. Everybody loved it because nobody paid it. The only people who paid the tax in 1913 were the Rockefellers, the Morgans, and the Astors. You know, gradually it went from a high class tax, upper class tax, to a mass tax. And by 1922, Congress had sort of organized it into a whole law, the Internal Revenue Code of 1922. Over the next 30 years, the lobbyists came in and threw in all these exemptions and credits. And by the time Eisenhower was elected in 52, it was a mess. And he demanded that we start over. And they did. They threw it out, rewrote a whole new code, the Internal Revenue Code of 1954. 30 years later, they'd started again. They threw the whole thing out. That was the code I've told you about, the Internal Revenue Code of 1986. The pattern here is every 32 years, 22, 54, 86, and guess what? The 32 years is up in 2018. The time has come. So if you agree with me that history repeats itself, we're going to do it.
I hope history repeats itself. But past performance is never a future indicator, right?
Yeah. You worked for Schwab, right?
That's right. Yeah. Kevin Hassert was just appointed as the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, and he came from the American Enterprise Institute. He's supposedly an expert on what makes the tax code work.
Yeah.
What do you think of him, and do you think he can be somebody that can help move some of these ideas along?
Yeah, I cite a couple of his papers in my book, and AEI definitely gets, American Enterprise Institute definitely gets this notion that you've got to simplify, get rid of all the giveaways so that you can get lower rates. So he understands that. It's politically difficult. But, he's a good person to explain this concept to members of Congress. So in my point of view, that's a good appointment.
Great. And, again, are there any others in Congress that you think could be helpful in this?
Yeah, there are several members of Congress.
Either Democrat or Republican.
Yeah, both parties.
Both parties.
Who definitely get it, who see the point. Nobody likes our current tax code. There's not a single member of Congress who would stand up and say, this is really good, let's keep it. And there are people who've put a lot of work into this who know how to do it. And then there's something called the Joint Committee on Taxation. And it's staffed with 100 tax professionals from both parties who know what they're doing. So there's definitely expertise there. The Treasury Department has tax experts. The IRS has this wonderful woman I told you about, Nina Olson, our advocate. There are people there who know how to do the right thing. The question is, can they stand up to the money and the lobbyists? And I say, I think maybe the time has come that we'll do it.
Great. So we've unfortunately reached the point in our program where we have time for one more question. And my question is, you've written 10 books. What's your next great idea for your next book?
Okay, so I've now done several books where I did this comparative policy analysis. I looked at how other countries get their crime rates down, how they provide health care for everybody, how they came up with a more sensible tax code, and we could learn from them. My publisher wants me to do how countries deal with an aging society. Mm. I mean, like, you know, you go to Japan, it's the oldest population in the world. If you go to the post office or the bank, on the counter there, they have a bunch of reading glasses. When you push the button for walk in Japan, to walk across the street, they have another button for slow walkers. And the light stays green twice as long.
That's also that way in Florida, you know.
Is it? Did that already? Yeah. So there are a lot of adjustments.
They haven't. They just automatically made all the lights slow.
But the one I want to do is, that's what my publisher wants. And, you know, she puts up the money. But Now, the book I've wanted to do for some time is a book about how Joseph Kennedy and Mayor Daley stole the 1960 election for Jack Kennedy. I think it definitely happened, and I think I know how it happened. So that's the one I want to do next. Would anybody here buy that book?
Yeah.
I'll tell my publisher. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's fabulous.
Yeah.
So our thanks to T.R. Reid, correspondent for The Washington Post, commentator for National Public Radio, and author of his new book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We also wish to remind everyone here that copies of Mr. Reid's book are for sale, and he'll be pleased to sign them following the program. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.